with a career and practice in nephrology, specializing in diabetes and obesity, today's guest, Dr. Jason Fong, did the right thing. He took time to observe and to acknowledge that there is no separate body part from the whole and no separate diseased condition. He has also taken the time to share, in layman's language, how we all can benefit from the knowledge and improve our lives. Jason's latest book is The Hunger Code. I'm Robin. Thanks for joining us on Tributaries. So Jason, your best-selling Obesity Code came out about 10 years back, and now The Hunger Code is about to hit. Is it new science, or could the publishing order have been reversed? Why the obesity book before The Hunger Code?
That's a good question. I think it's because a lot of it actually covers some new science that's really gotten a lot of recognition only within the last 5 years. The whole discussion about ultra-processed foods, food addictions, and a lot of the hormonal stuff, which is relies on like GLP-1s, which is affected by, say, Ozempic, a lot of that is relatively recent. So that's why it's coming out after, although really, if you think about it, it is follow-up to it, because as we delve deeper into this cause of obesity, which is really the focus of these two books, the hunger is really the root cause. But a lot of this was not delineated or not well known at the time I wrote the Obesity Code. Think about how hormones create sort of this overeating behavior. You have to really step back and say, well, why? Why do we eat, right? And it's because you're hungry. And if you don't take care of the hunger part, you'll never actually solve the eating behavior. If you simply eat less, then you get more hungry, and eventually you just fail. And that's the lesson of drugs like Ozempic, which don't restrict calories, but what they do is they restrict hunger. And when you restrict the hunger, then the calorie sort of naturally follows, whereas if you restrict calories, it doesn't work. If you really want to think about getting to the root cause of the problem, one, we eat when we're hungry, and we stop eating when we're full. So that's really the root cause. And everybody knows it's true, so why do we ignore that, right? Why do we just say, just stop eating, right? Because the problem is not the overeating, it's really the overhunger, if you will. Just like if you have alcoholism is alcohol in minus alcohol out, you could simply give the advice, just drink less alcohol. Is that useful advice? Absolutely not, because right. You never got into the reason why people are drinking the alcohol. Maybe it's depression, maybe it's post-traumatic stress disorder, maybe it's addiction. Then you have to deal with the addiction, which is causing them to drink more alcohol, right? And the same reason with calories, it's because of the hunger that's driving it. And what types of hunger there are? When you delve into the literature, there's really three types of hunger, at least different types of hunger. And that is the homeostatic hunger, which we all think about, physical hunger. And scientifically, this is called homeostatic hunger. And then there's also hedonic hunger, which is eating for pleasure. And there's also conditioned hunger, which is the sort of habits that we all develop. You know, I've read a lot of diet books, and 90% are about how to restrict calories. Things are changing a little bit. So just in yesterday's New York Times, there was an article by Pete Wells, who's a well-known writer there, and he said, well, really to restrict all this food noise, you have to really look at what causes hunger. And today, there's another article about, is America breaking up with the calorie? That was in today's New York Times. I'm quoted in that as well.
That's a certainly great direction to go in, breaking up with the calories.
Yeah.
You are a doctor, and you are a researcher and author, obviously. There's so much scientific research that's going on, and yet when we look at all of the results from looking at all the science, a lot of it does come down to common sense. I think one of those is, oh, I have terrible willpower, and yet that's not the whole picture at all. There's actually quite a Pandora's box here, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. Think about it this way. Suppose you eat 800 calories of steak and eggs in the morning. It's going to keep you full, at least until lunch, maybe even till dinner, because it's really such a big breakfast. Or you have like a 3-egg omelet with vegetables or something like that. Now, imagine that you drink 800 calories of Frappuccino. In the steak and eggs, you're going to be full until lunch or dinner. In the Frappuccino, you're hungry like 5 minutes later, right? So why pretend that they're the same thing? So what's the difference between the two? Well, they have the same calories, but that's not the point. The point is that when you eat food, it contains both calories and information.
Yes,
that's information
great.
Is the hormonal response, right? So when you eat steak and eggs, certain hormones in your body go up and others don't. So insulin doesn't go up, which tells our body, hey, don't store it. Leave it out there. So it leaves all the calories out there for you to use for the rest of the day. That's why you're not hungry. At the same time, it stimulates peptide YY, cholecystokinin, GLP-1, GIP, and those are satiety hormones. So that tells your body, hey, you're full, don't eat anymore. On the other hand, you drink the Frappuccino with all its sugar and refined carbohydrates. Well, what happens? Well, one, insulin goes way up, right? And that's going to store all those calories. So the minute you take those 800 calories, all of it gets shuttled immediately into storage. Well, there's no calories left for the rest of the body. So 5 minutes later, you're like, you know, I need to go eat something. It doesn't stimulate peptide YY, cholecystokinin, GLP-1, or GIP, which means that there's no satiety created. So foods contain calories, yes, but that's not the end of the story. This is where calories is such shallow first-order thinking. But the body responds to those two calories completely differently. And it's not a question of thermodynamics. Anybody who says that doesn't understand it. The point is that different foods are different in terms of their fattening effect. That's all. Some calories are more fattening than others. Brownies are more fattening than broccoli. Isn't that pure common sense?
You know, I would like to have you share a little bit about the order in which foods are eaten in a meal.
Because So everything depends on the hormones. Different foods can have different hormone effects depending on how you eat them, for example. So we always think of the, you know, whether it's calories or carbohydrates, this intrinsic property of the food, and that determines how much fattening effect it has, which is the insulin, the hormone effects, right? And there's actually a lot that goes in between them. So in the book, I talk about what goes from the food to the digestion, which is how your body breaks it down, to absorption, which is how the body takes the calories, the carbohydrates, the glucose, and gets it into the blood, absorbs it into the bloodstream. And then that affects the hormones, which affects your weight, tells your body gain fat or don't gain fat, and then, weight gain. And anywhere along the line, you can actually change the effect. So you can take the same food, and they've done this study where they give people white bread and orange juice, and they give it first, and then they give chicken and vegetables. Then they took the same people, and they switched the order. So they gave them the chicken and vegetables first, and then got the white bread and orange juice. If you eat the carbs first, you have a much, much higher glucose spike and a much higher insulin effect. It's actually quite striking. It's like 50, 60% higher insulin response if you eat the carbohydrates first. The reason that's important is because it's the hormones that tell our body what we're supposed to do. That's what hormones are. They're chemical messengers to tell your body what to do. So the more insulin you stimulate, the more signal you're giving your body to store fat. This is the exact same food. There's no difference in the two foods, and there's no difference in the people because each person has done them in both directions, right? It's the order in which you ate them. And that's really important because when you're thinking about digestion and absorption, what happens is that when you eat the bread and the orange juice first, it goes into your stomach, and the stomach actually acts as a reservoir. So it's going to mix the food and grind it up and then put it into the small intestines for absorption. When you eat the bread and orange juice, what goes into the small intestines is basically 100% glucose, which is carbohydrate. So you absorb it very quickly. It's refined carbohydrate. Whereas if you eat the chicken and vegetables first, by the time you eat that bread and the orange juice, you've mixed it all around. And what goes into the small intestine now is a mix of chicken, vegetables, bread, and orange juice. So then your body absorbs it much more slowly because the stomach is sort of pushing it out just a little bit at a time. So that's why it's important to look at other aspects, because it's not necessarily a low carbohydrate diet, but a low insulin diet, because it's the hormones that are effective in the long run.
Yes, yes. And you write about resetting the body's fat thermostat, and that sounds like that's part of it.
Yeah. So the fat thermostat is the way that our bodies create homeostasis. So homeostasis is a property where your body sets a certain level and then adjusts to get back to that level. So body temperature is a perfect example. So you set your body temperature at normal body temperature. If you live in the Sahara Desert, you're very hot, so you sweat. And that cools your body back down to body temperature. If you live in the North Pole, you shiver, and that creates body heat, which gets your body temperature back up. So that's an example of homeostasis, but that's actually true for almost all physiologic measures. So if you eat a lot of salt, you pee out a lot of salt. If you don't eat a lot of salt, you won't pee out a lot of salt. It's true for potassium, electrolytes. It's true for body temperature. It's true for basically everything. In the human body. And that includes how much body fat we carry. So the thing is that people often say that, oh, we're designed to store fat. Now that food is easy to get, we're all going to get fat. And that's completely untrue because you can look at other places in the world where there's food available, Japan, for example, food easily available. You can buy it anywhere you want from a vending machine or whatever. There's very little obesity, right, compared to the United States. You can look back in our history. So there are lots of times where people have had easy access to food but no obesity. And you look at, say, the biblical story of Joseph, 7 years of plenty. They don't talk about 7 years of morbid obesity. It wasn't. But there was a lot of food, right?
Right.
So the point is that your body wants to stay at a certain percentage of body fat. Think about a wild animal. If you are a predator and are too fat, you won't catch anything. If you're a prey animal and you're too fat, you're going to die right away. Some animal's going to eat you. If you have too little body fat, you won't survive the winter. So your body has an optimal set point, which is like a thermostat. The thing is that there are certain hormones that push up this thermostat, and there are certain hormones that push down this thermostat. What pushes it up? Well, insulin will push it up. Cortisol will push it up. What will push it down? GLP-1, leptin, GIP, glucagon. So there's all these different hormones that push it up and down. And I list, I think, 12 different hormones that push it up or down. The easiest thing to think about is puberty. During puberty, before puberty, boys and girls have about the same amount of body fat. After puberty, girls have about 50% more body fat. Why? It's not willpower. It's because girls have a lot of estrogen. Boys have a lot of testosterone. Girls get their thermostat pushed up so that they store extra fat in their breasts and their hips. Boys with their testosterone get pushed to create more muscle. It's the hormones that have pushed that body fat thermostat up or down, telling the body to either store fat in the breasts and hips in the case of girls or create muscle in case of boys. But in either case, you have to understand the hormones that are going to push it up or push it down, because that's how you're going to be successful in losing weight, not by counting calories. Just as if in the body temperature example, you don't say, well, what's the source of heat in minus heat out, like you have a fever. Well, that's because your body generated more heat than it dissipated.
Yes.
True enough, but it's because you have an infection, right? So this whole idea of calories is such a simplistic sort of shallow thinking.
Yes. Talking about being satiated and wanting to eat food, there are so many other things as well. The fact that there's a nutrient density that our bodies are craving is part of everything.
Yeah. I think from the calories example, I talk in the Hunger Code about the three whys. What it is a concept in logic. That is, if you want to really understand a problem, you have to ask the question why three times. So if you ask the question, for example, why did the Titanic sink? The wrong answer is because it hit an iceberg. Technically, it's correct, but if you think about it, why did the Titanic sink? Because it hit an iceberg. So what advice would you give to future captains to prevent marine disasters? Don't hit icebergs. It's like, is that really useful advice? Not really, because everybody knows that, right? Because that's the shallow first-order thinking. You have to ask the second why, which is, why did the Titanic hit the iceberg? And the answer is the captain couldn't avoid it. The third why is, why couldn't the captain avoid it? And the answer is because it was going too fast. So the real answer of why the Titanic sank is because it was going too fast. Now you actually get useful advice to say, hey, if you want to prevent marine disasters, you need to slow down. Just like if you're to say, why did the person crash on that snowy road? Usually it's because they were going too fast. The point is that calories is the same thing. If you ask the question, why is somebody gaining weight? The answer, because calories in is greater than calories out. Yes, that is true, but that is the don't hit icebergs advice. The second question is, why is calories in greater than calories out? Because I'm not interested that calories in is greater than calories out. I know that already because they're gaining weight. I want to know why. And the answer is because they're hungry. There are certain things that cause hunger, certain things that cause satiety. And the third sort of even more interesting question to me is, why are you hungry? And there's actually the three types, which is the physical hunger, which is the homeostatic hunger, which is all these hormones we're talking about. But there's a hedonic hunger. Hedonic hunger, hedonic refers to pleasure. It makes us feel good. We call them comfort foods. They're foods that give us comfort. Well, if you need a lot of comfort because you're depressed, you can certainly overeat. That's emotional eating. Well, again, we know it happens. Why deny it and say eat fewer calories? Because the problem is the hedonic hunger, not the homeostatic physical hunger. This is the emotional hunger. And that's where food addictions, ultra-processed foods really starts to play a role. And then there's a third, which is conditioned hunger. That is, you can actually create hunger by pairing food with all different types of stimuli. So again, think about the current situation in the United States. You eat in the car. You eat in front of the TV. You eat in front of the movies. You eat in front of your desk. You eat when you're reading a book. You eat when you're walking down the street. Now all of a sudden you pair all these things, and so you get in the car and you get hungry because you're conditioned that way.
Right.
Compare that to 50, 60, 70 years ago in the same United States. No eating in front of the TV, right? The TV dinner was sort of a 70s, 80s sort of thing, right?
Right.
There's no eating in the theater. There's no eating in the car. There's no eating walking down the street. You only ate at a table with other people. Well, you're going to control that hunger because you haven't associated it with all the things. I mean, the classic experiment in behavioral psychology is Pavlov's dogs, right? So Pavlov's dogs, they salivate when they see food. But then when you pair a bell, so you ring a dinner bell and then bring the dog's food, they soon start to salivate as soon as they hear the bell, which is called a neutral stimulus because a bell should not stimulate hunger.
Right,
but it does
yes.
because it's been paired so often with the food. We're actually creating extra hunger because we're conditioned to snack all the time. Hey, it's breakfast. You got to eat. Hey, it's mid-morning. You got to have a snack. Hey, it's coffee. We got to have a donut. Hey, it's lunchtime. You got to eat. Hey, it's after school. You got to eat. Hey, it's dinner time. You got to eat. Hey, you're going to bed. You need to eat. All of a sudden, you've got all these things that are creating the hunger, which is driving the eating behavior.
If someone would have a glass of water when they first think they're hungry, is that something people can do to ward off that habit?
Yeah, over time it creates a habit. So if you have, say, a big cup of coffee or green tea in the morning and you just get used to it, that hunger that you get in the morning very quickly dissipates. Again, you're conditioning yourself. One of the things that often we say is that hunger is a liar. And what we mean by that is that people think that hunger means that your body needs sustenance, which is calories, right? That's the energy contained. And it isn't. If somebody is 50 pounds overweight, they've got 175,000 calories sitting in storage.
Yes.
So why should you get hungry? So it doesn't make sense that hunger is a signal that you're craving sustenance.
Right.
It's a liar.
Yeah.
Yes, you do get hungry, but that's because hormones are telling you to be hungry. A lot of times it's conditioned hunger. So I'm in the middle of a 3-day fast, for example. So I won't eat for 3 days. But I still get hungry at dinner time. And it's not because I need the calories. It's because I've been conditioned because I eat dinner most of the time.
Yes. And Jason, this is a perfect intro to what I most appreciate about your work is the introduction and reasoning and science behind the intermittent fasting.
Thank you. Yeah, fasting is an interesting thing. In my book, I have three golden rules. One is getting rid of ultra-processed foods, which is actually super important. And part of the most recent dietary guidelines is actually the most important thing that was recommended. And mostly because the ultra-processed foods really creates that hedonic hunger.
Yes.
But the second is fasting. It's really important to get rid of all those conditioned stimuli, for example. You want to create less hunger by doing more fasting. The easiest is to go to like a 16-hour fast. Remember that most people should be fasting for 12 to 14 hours. Like, for example, if you eat dinner at 6 o'clock and eat breakfast at 8 a.m., that's 14 hours of fasting, right? And that used to be not even called fasting. That was just like normal day, right?
Right.
If you wanted an after-dinner snack, your mom would say, no, you should have ate more at dinner, right? Which is the whole point. You don't eat all the time. There's a time and a place that you eat. And if you didn't eat enough, well, you should have just suck it up. That was sort of the message of that whole exchange, which happened quite a lot in the 70s when
right.
I grew up. So 12 to 14 hours is sort of a normal fasting period. And that's where the term breakfast comes in, right? The meal that breaks your fast because you've been fasting for 14 hours. Now, if you want to lose weight, fasting is nothing more than giving your body more time to release the calories that it's stored. And body fat is a store of calories, so you're using it for what it was designed for. There's nothing bad or unusual about it. But people think they'll do 16 hours and then they can eat whatever they want. That's only a very minor increase on the normal fasting period that everybody's supposed to have every single day. So you can go to 24 hours, which is one meal a day, or you can go past that into multiple days. As you go higher and higher, it tends to be stronger, but it tends to be a little bit more difficult, mostly because of social reasons, but also you have to have a plan to deal with the hunger, right? Because the conditioned hunger, the hedonic hunger, they're real. So while you may not need the calories from a physical standpoint, because remember, your body has hundreds of thousands of calories, so it can release it if it needs to. When I do these longer fasts, so a few weeks ago I did a five-day fast, it's not the physical hunger that limits me. It's the sight of the food and my thinking, ooh, I would really like to eat that. Not because I'm physically hungry, right? It's dessert. Nobody eats dessert because they are hungry physically. You just ate a meal. You're not physically hungry. You eat it because it looks good, it tastes good, and it gives you pleasure in there. And that's where the green teas are useful, the coffee is useful, the bone broth is useful. When I do the fast, during dinner time, I actually will plan to do something else, usually like a little running or swimming or something, something that takes my mind sort of completely off of the meal so that it breaks that conditioned hunger. The more you know, the better you do. You're coming up with a decent plan, but you have to know about it before you can set these plans in motion. So I don't think I've ever seen any book talk about any of these concepts. Why? They're all really important, logical, common sense parts of human eating behavior that we all acknowledge to be true.
Right. You brought up the new food pyramid, and honestly, I've never paid attention to any food pyramid, but I like that they've made a new one, and it actually is something that's worthwhile looking at, right?
Yeah, I think so. And there's a couple things I really like about it. First, the emphasis on the real food. I think that is more important than anything else.
Yes.
Because that's the overlying thing that we always have to think about. Eating real food is important because the body knows how to handle those real foods. It will create natural satiety signaling, so you'll know how much to eat and how much to when to stop. With artificial foods, you often don't know when to stop because that's what they do deliberately, right? They make it not fill you up so that you'll eat more and buy more and the food companies will make more money. The other thing I really like is the old pyramid was horrible, truthfully, right? At the bottom, there's like all this grains and proteins, and then meat was the third rung up, third out of four, and it's only half of that. So basically, you're basically eating no protein at all. Which, of course, means that you're not getting enough protein, which is they raise the recommended amount of protein in the guidelines as well. You know, I think a lot of people have already acknowledged that, hey, getting enough protein is kind of important for muscle growth and all this sort of stuff. But the other thing I really like is how they flip the whole pyramid upside down, which is an implicit admission that the old pyramid was basically all wrong. And I think that's great because I think you have to be honest. If you were to ask somebody, hey, look at this old food pyramid, which they never rescinded, right? We should be eating 7 to 10 slices of bread per day. Does anybody think they should anymore?
Well, who even did?
Yeah, exactly. I asked some friends and they're like, this new food pyramid is good. It's basically how we're eating now, right? It's like, yeah.
But yes.
Yet somebody official had to say, yes, that old pyramid was really, really wrong.
Right.
This is a better guide. Well, I mean, it's not a huge change for a lot of people who pay attention to the nutrition space because the old one was just so, you know, you should eat sweets like, you know, or fats monthly, right? What? You're telling me you shouldn't be eating avocados and salmon and once a month you're going to eat olive oil? Avocados, really? Like, that doesn't make sense. But every 5 years it is the same, right? To save face, they didn't want to admit it was wrong. Finally, somebody's like, it's all wrong.
And Jason, in closing here, I know you've written other code books. What is the thread that really runs through all of them?
The thread behind all the code books is really to try and get a real deep understanding of the underlying disease. So obesity, what is the underlying problem? Not the superficial don't hit icebergs advice. What's the actual problem? And that the obesity code went down into the hormonal side of things. And then the hunger code is really getting into the deep weeds of human eating behavior. So it's not just about the hormones, but about the hedonic hunger, conditioned hunger, right? And why they're important aspects in eating behavior. The diabetes code, again, is really about getting to understand what is causing type 2 diabetes. It's really a dietary disease. And then the cancer code, well, there's less practical advice there, but the cancer code was a really deep dive into the current thinking on what causes cancer and what is cancer. Thought of cancer as a disease of unchecked growth, which is fine, but it doesn't explain why is the growth unchecked. The third why, what are the processes that are driving that evolution? That's what the cancer code was about. The thread of all those is what causes it. At a very, very deep level.
Back to the intermittent fasting, heart doctors are calling for this as well. It's made such a huge difference for people with all kinds of different problems. So thank you again for really going into this line of research. People can really grab a handle on something and make a difference for themselves.
Yeah, things are changing. It's a very interesting progression that we've had, this sort of increasing recognition that calories is just really, really shallow.
Yeah.
You know, alcohol in minus alcohol out. And it's,
right.
It's true, but that's not the end. That's only the beginning.
Yeah, I have a new saying now after speaking with you. It's so first why. The Hunger Code is Dr. Jason Fung's latest book. For anything we do here, it's tributariesradio.com, and our podcasts are where you hope to find them. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.